This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Southern rock as a music style brings to mind the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd. Certainly the genre did get its start with the Allman Brothers back in 1969 and blossomed through the 1970s. Yet another version of rock from the South came a decade later with bands such as REM, and yet again in this century, thanks to bands like the Drive-By Truckers. We hear a bit of all of these bands right here. I wish that you was here so everyone would know. People say you were useless, then people all were fools. Cause Curtis, you're the finest picker to ever play the blues.
Thing. Stay out the way of the Southern thing. Stay out the way of the Southern thing.
Southern rock in its various forms has been a soundtrack for the life of Mark Kemp. In his new book, Dixie Lullaby, a story of music, race, and new beginnings in a new South, Mark Kemp chronicles his own personal history with the music. And Mark Kemp joins us right now from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, where he lives. Hi there, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing, Melinda?
Fine. Welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you'd like to join our conversation this hour, our number is 1-877-962-9862. If you have your own take on what Southern rock is, what it means, give us a call. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, Mark, you've written this book, Dixie Lullaby, and I have to wonder, this is a memoir, but it also takes us through the history, the social history of Southern rock. Why did you combine those two things?
Well, you know, it didn't start out to be a memoir at all. I kind of wrote a proposal which became the preface of my own experiences growing up in the South just after desegregation, and how during that period we had no social role models, at least white kids didn't. Black kids had Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, but we had Lester Maddox and George Wallace, you know. And in writing that proposal/preface, the publishers and the editor asked if I would inject myself into this story after I kind of already had in the first chapter. They said, keep on with that angle because it's compelling. Your experience is compelling. And so it turned into kind of a social history of the South of a certain period, this very transitional period that hadn't been written about often. The 60s period had, but not so much the 70s post-desegregation period. And then so I injected myself into it, and of course music, because that's my profession, mm-hmm. writing about music.
Right. Now, in the 1970s, you were born in 1960, and in the 1970s, you're growing up in Asheboro, in the middle of the
right.
state, Asheboro, North Carolina. And you describe yourself as somewhat of a geeky kid in school. And so did that play into the way you really took to this music, or what?
Well, I don't know. It played into insecurity, that's for sure. And I think all of us go through that to one extent or another. I happen to be kind of a music geek, so I gravitated towards music, and so did a lot of my friends. And you have to remember that this is the period just after the whole hippie thing, and we were still kind of emulating hippies. And that's the direction we kind of went into. And when this music, and we listened to everything from the Rolling Stones to, you know, Black Sabbath. But it just, when the Allman Brothers hit and Lynyrd Skynyrd hit, it was like a seismic shift in the way I felt about music, because these were bands who were white bands playing music that was really familiar to me growing up in the South, you know, kind of a combination of black blues and white country, and in the Allman Brothers case, jazz. So yeah, I was a music geek who was just kind of floored by this brand new kind of music.
Yeah, you have a section in the book where you talk about the first time you heard this was on an 8-track, which I always identify with Southern rock too, because I was in high school at that time. And you talk about driving around in your older sister's Mustang And she
Mach 1, yeah.
And she pulls this out of the glove box and says, you've got to listen to this. And so so what was it that was it just because they were from your part of the world that resonated with you?
Not at that time. I mean, you know, she was playing T-Rex or Rolling Stones or whatever she was playing before. And she just, I remember her saying, you got to listen to this band. They're really cool. They're from Georgia. And I just remember going, Georgia? You know, to me at that time, I had no clue that rock and roll was born in the South because I was 11 years old. You know, to me, rock and roll was all about these British glamorous, you know, rock stars who wore skin tight pants and these cool boots and sequined jumpsuits and, you know, wore eyeliner and all that stuff, you know. And so she brings out this 8-track with this band on it that looks, you know, like guys in my high school or her high school. I just thought, you know, this can't be good. And she put it in. And that's when the music really resonated because it had that, as I said, it had that kind of that country feel that was genuine and not like the country, the kind of faux country that the Rolling Stones kind of did, which was kind of a mocking sort of thing. And it had a genuine blues feel. And it also had this gospel element. You played Revival at the very first of this show. And Revival reminded me of the kind of music that I'd hear when I'd go through. Back then, there was a black section of town, you know. And I'd go through that section of town. I'd hear from the churches this music coming out. And it sounded like that. And that really was compelling to me because I could really identify with it on a visceral and a very personal level.
And that's when you were 11. Now, you right now, I guess it would be about 43 years later.
Yikes.
Sorry to remind
you. No, not 43 years later.
Excuse me, 33 years later because you're 44 now. 33 years later.
Right.
And you write about it and now you say there was something, issues of race there going on too, that you say that the Allman Brothers created a soundtrack that relieved young Southerners of the weightiness of their guilt, fear, and economic insecurities, the family legacies of racism, the drudgeries of a rural working class existence. But I'm curious how the music you heard there provided that relief to a family legacy of racism. Or leave behind what you describe as burdens of guilt.
Right. You know, I was thinking that the first moment that I heard that music at 11 years old, I'm joking here. But no,
you're
really
very precocious, yes.
Right. In retrospect, when I look back, we had certain ideas of race. You know, growing up white in the South during that period, there were certain ideas of race that were programmed in young white children and in young black children. I'm sure I wasn't a young black person, but my family, my extended family anyway, were extremely racist, and they felt that blacks were inferior, and that's just the way it was. And then there was all this talk of change, you know, since the civil rights legislation of the 50s and in the 60s, of this desegregation thing and this integration thing. I had no idea what these words meant, but I did, because of little incidents that happened that I kind of describe in my book, you know, hearing comments from my aunts and uncles and seeing disparities and stuff like that, I did see that something was wrong. You know, at my young age, you know, this looked very, very wrong. By the time that I heard the Allman Brothers, the schools had already been desegregated. But, you know, there were no classes in tolerance back then. And there were a lot of problems, and there was a lot of adjusting. And so when I say that the Allman Brothers relieved us of a lot of that, there was a mourning to the Allman Brothers music. There was a sadness, a deep, deep sadness to the music, both in the guitar of Duane Allman and in the voice of Greg Allman, who sang like a gospel singer, you know. And I think more than the Rolling Stones, which kind of, you know, they were an ironic group. They were a smart, ironic group that sang, you know, kind of, when they sang country or blues, it was with their tongue in their cheek. And when the Allman Brothers sang country or blues, it was totally genuine. So I think a lot of the feelings expressed in these songs, whether it was pride like Blue Sky, or real shame and sadness like Dreams, where he says, I went up to the mountaintop to see what I could see. Looked like the whole world was falling down on me. All of that was very... It just seemed very appropriate, and it spoke to me and a lot of my friends during a time when we were feeling all those feelings, that joy, pride, sadness, shame.
Yeah. And the Allman Brothers, it's been said over and over, they had a black drummer. And was that significant? Was that a part of this show?
It was hugely significant at the time. I mean, we think now, you know, okay, they had a black drummer. You know, what's new? But it was new then, particularly among a rock band, a very popular rock band. I don't think it was so new among jazz heads down in New Orleans. You know, they would jam in clubs. But a popular rock band in Rolling Stone magazine, yeah, that was really huge. And particularly people outside of the South would go, gosh, these white guys are playing with a black guy? We had no idea that happened.
We're talking this hour with Mark Kemp. His new book is Dixie Lullaby, A Story of Music, Race, and New Beginnings in a New South. We're talking about Southern rock music. And we're taking your calls. Our number's 1-877-962-9862. More of our conversation coming up in just a moment. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. When he was growing up in Asheboro, Mark Kemp was surrounded by music that came to be labeled Southern rock. But later, as a music journalist at Rolling Stone magazine and an executive at MTV, Kemp found himself covering punk, hip-hop, and alternative styles. Eventually, though, he returned to the music of the South, and he explores that personal relationship to Southern rock in his new book, Dixie Lullaby, A Story of Music, Race, and New Beginnings in a New South. And Mark Kemp is with us today from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Let's go to Rudy in Raleigh right now. Hi there, Rudy.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I went to school with Mark, and I'm actually very proud of him that he's come out with a book. I've got a pretty simple question for you here. It is, how would one objectively define what is Southern rock? It seems in many ways it's one of those types of things that you know when you hear it. But are there objective measures that you use to define what Southern rock is? For instance, is it the presence of a slide guitar or the slower drum pace that you would find compared to other songs or the presence of harmonizing guitars and voice or gravelly vocals? What do you use as a defining
factor? Or is it that the musicians come from the South?
Good point. For instance, I wouldn't consider REM a Southern band, but I might consider the Doobies a Southern band. What criteria do you use?
Well, you know, actually, it's totally subjective. Southern rock to me was the rock that I and my friends listened to growing up in the South during a certain period of time. No, it's I didn't really base it on the style of music, because then as you say, the Doobie Brothers could be Southern rock, Foghat could be Southern rock, Humble Pie in England could be Southern rock, the Rolling Stones could be Southern rock. You know, I didn't define it musically. I defined it more socially, culturally, and personally.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer satisfy you, Rudy?
Yes, it does. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Rudy.
Thanks for the call. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Well, you know, Mark Kemp, we were talking a moment ago about the Allman Brothers, the first breakthrough band to be considered Southern rock. But then shortly after that came out Lynyrd Skynyrd. And they were somewhat different. Would you say they were a different situation than the Allman Brothers? Because you described the Allman Brothers as ones, a band that helped you come to grips with the idea of race and being white in the South after desegregation. And Lynyrd Skynyrd is a little more complicated.
Yeah, they're a lot more complicated. And I think they're, you know, if you read my book and, you know, take it cumulatively, you see what looks kind of like a pattern that follows a trauma. You see extreme sadness in the Allman Brothers band. And then that's followed by anger. Now, you know, if someone dies in your family, you know, at first you're just completely mourning, you know, and you're crying and you're uncontrollably sad. And then suddenly you're angry. You're really angry that this change has happened in your life. And I think Lynyrd Skynyrd represented that. They were angry and they were rowdy and they were saying, gosh, we're proud to be Southern, even though there's little to be proud of yet in terms of race and what was going on in the world. But I think Lynyrd Skynyrd got to the point where they were kind of tired of hearing songs from other parts of the world and the country that constantly talked about how horrible Southern people were. And they wrote that song very simply, I think, as kind of a joke and kind of serious. They liked Neil Young, but Neil Young had done two songs, Southern Man and Alabama, that pretty much painted the whole White South as a cesspool of racism. And they wrote Sweet Home Alabama, which really resonated across the country, kind of in a way, I think, because they had the chutzpah to write it.
Right.
And
but it's somewhat open to interpretation exactly where they were going with it. And I'd like to play a section here, and this is where they're referencing the governor of Alabama, mm-hmm. George Wallace at the time, who, you know, a decade earlier had been trying to stop desegregation efforts there. But let's hear Lynyrd Skynyrd from Sweet Home Alabama. Lynyrd Skynyrd and Sweet Home Alabama there. We were talking with Mark Kemp, whose new book is Dixie Lullaby. Well, Mark Kemp, Sweet Home Alabama, as you were saying, was a response to Neil Young's songs and other songs, but Neil Young in particular, Southern Man and Alabama, which had drawn scorn upon the South, led scorn on the South in its depictions of Southerners. And so you had Lynyrd Skynyrd coming along with Sweet Home Alabama as a response. But what exactly were they getting at there with lyrics about the governor of Alabama?
You know, that particular verse has been scrutinized to death since the death of Lynyrd Skynyrd. There's a section where they go, now we all love the governor, boo, are in Birmingham, they love the governor, boo, 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 is what a lot of, some critics have interpreted that as boo, 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 we're just kidding. I did a lot of talking to ex-members of Lynyrd Skynyrd and other and other music insiders, and there's a lot of disagreement over whether that was boo 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 or just some kind of musical beat. I don't know, whatever it is. But one thing I did come away with from their former guitar player Ed King is that they all supported George Wallace during that period. And you have to understand, during that period, George Wallace had the support of the majority of blacks in Alabama. It was a very different period when they wrote and recorded that song, 73, 74, than it was in 69, in the 60s, early 60s, when he was blocking doors to colleges. George Wallace was a complicated, in some ways, and predictable in other ways, politician who kind of just went with the whatever populist movement was, you know, vogue at the time. One thing is for sure, when George Wallace honored them with some kind of honorary lieutenants of the Alabama militia, or there's some crazy
colonels
thing
they were, or
something like that. They were thrilled about it. And Ed King, the former guitarist of Lynyrd Skynyrd, who wrote the guitar part for that song, said that they were George Wallace supporters. But he also mentioned Lynyrd Skynyrd wasn't a political band. Ronnie Van Zant wrote songs based on purely on his feelings, and which is the appeal of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I think sometimes we've tried to overanalyze that band. In the first place, you know, in the early days, as these racist rednecks or these gritty poor kids, and now as maybe misunderstood liberals. And, you know, I don't think they were any of that. I mean, they may have been scrappy, young, you know, poor kids. That's the one truth. They were a rock and roll band, and Ronnie Van Zant was a storyteller, and he wrote a song.
Now, who was viewing them as misunderstood liberals?
There's a writer, and I love him to death, so I don't want to diss him on air, but his name is Lee Ballinger, and he's a very political writer. He's a wonderful person. But he's written an essay on how the boo 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 was boo boo boo. And also John Swinson, I think, who's written pretty extensively on Lynyrd Skynyrd. He wrote, I think, the liner notes to the box set of old Lynyrd Skynyrd. And both of them, and Al Cooper, the producer, the Yankee producer, I think they called him a Yankee slicker in one of their songs, has also kind of repeated that story. So that story is not from, you know, just average Joes. These are, you know, players. But then on the other hand, Ed King and Charlie Daniels and some others who knew Ronnie Van Zant very well deny that and say they're, you know, that's just a bunch of crap.
Right. Now, the other thing we should talk about here with Lynyrd Skynyrd, and perhaps contributing to this view of them being racist, would be that the Confederate flag starts showing up in their shows. In fact, you write in your book that it was their manager, who was from the Northeast, who suggested that they put a Confederate flag as a backdrop on their
exactly. Ironically, yes, it was Al Cooper and MCA Records that suggested that maybe that Confederate flag would be, you know, would just kind of nail home the point that these were proud Southern boys. The Confederate flag at that time was not quite the hot potato that it is today. It may very well have been in the black community, but it wasn't quite the hot potato that it is today. And that's what infuriates me, that the current Lynyrd Skynyrd uses that Confederate flag again. At some point during Lynyrd Skynyrd's original run, when they were really Lynyrd Skynyrd, they stopped using that Confederate flag just because of its meaning. Now they use it again, and that's a shame.
And for those not familiar with the Lynyrd Skynyrd story, many of the original band members died in a plane crash in 1977, among them Ronnie Van Zant, who was the lead singer, and now it is his younger brother who revived the band about a decade or two later, and is now touring as Lynyrd Skynyrd, but with a different Van Zant brother in the lead there. And they played last week at the before the GOP convention, I understand, at some parties in New York.
Right, and they are a decidedly right-wing band right now, I would say. Back then, as many people that I've talked to around Lynyrd Skynyrd told me, they were not a very political band. I mean, the most political they got was playing for Carter. During his presidential campaign. I don't think they were nearly as political and active as, say, the Allman Brothers, but it looks like they're pretty conservative these days. But it's a very different band. There's only a couple of members left that are original. And they're kind of following the sheep. I mean, in terms of writing songs about red, white, and blue, and blah 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 blah, kind of Toby Keith type songs. And that wasn't the original Lynyrd Skynyrd. They weren't that way at all. They were very original. When you look back at the songs that of theirs, like "That Smell" and "Free Bird" and "What's Your Name," and these songs, although played constantly today on classic rock radio, were really, really different.
Mm-hmm. Could you say the same thing? I think I picked up on that theme in your book, too, about the early Allman Brothers. The purer form of these bands were in their early days, in their early efforts. And what came later, even by the mid-late 70s, it was morphing into something else. And it was just, was it more mainstream and it just wasn't quite as special?
You know, that kind of happens with all rock bands. I mean, practically all rock bands. Some managed to eke out a creative career for forever and ever. But I mean, you know, you look at the Rolling Stones and look at what they're doing, it's pretty boring now. You look at David Bowie and what he's doing, it's pretty boring now. It's hard for a rock and roll band to have that hungry, edgy, angry, joyful, you know, passion that they had when they were in their 20s and early 30s, you know?
Mm-hmm. We go to Keith. Keith is with us in Madison. Hi there, Keith.
Hey, how are y'all today?
Fine. Did you have a question for Mark Kemp?
Yeah, I'm enjoying the show a whole lot. Hey, Mark, I just wanted to say that songwriters from that period, it seems like the bands you've been discussing wrote what they liked and what was on their mind and what was their agenda at the time. So many times you hear, just like you mentioned, the drummer for the Allman Brothers being a black guy, that I think that the people have chosen to make their music sometimes a racial overtone, as opposed to when they were writing it really being a song that, that was racial. I think they were liberal in many respects, as many people in the music industry are. And enjoyed the bands, enjoyed your show, and I just wanted to tell you all that. I grew up listening to them, but it certainly didn't bring that out to me. Some of the younger folks today, you see wearing the Confederate flag hat and so forth like that, don't understand. And maybe want to use that as a symbol for their teenage rebellious nature, but for the most part, those bands back then were playing music that was derived from black heritage and people that played the blues and that type of music. And that's all I want to say. Y'all have a good day.
Keith, thank you. Mark Kemp.
Thanks, Keith. That's simplifying just a tad, I think. You can't separate popular culture from culture, in my opinion. And I don't think that you can just listen to a band like the Allman Brothers or Lynyrd Skynyrd and not consider the times. And the times were rife with racial antagonism. And in the beginning of my book, I preface and introduce the book with a couple of chapters, the preface and the introduction, about the kind of the genesis of integrated music. Long before the Allman Brothers, blacks and whites worked in studios together. The whites were usually studio musicians, and they would back singers like Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett and Aretha Franklin. And when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, a lot of the blacks stopped working with white musicians for obvious reasons. It wasn't politically a good idea. It was symbolically not such a good idea. And so a lot of this white studio musicians started forming their own bands, and they drew from the music of those great singers and from their own background, you know, and that normally was country music or whatever.
So it forced them inward. Is that what it forced them?
It forced white them session to find musicians? Find themselves. And Duane Allman was one of those musicians, and he just happened to be one of the, you know, one of the better ones, and in fact, you know, to me, you know, kind of a musical genius. He was brilliant. But yes, it forced those guys to start looking inside and looking at themselves, and not just kind of being following on the coattails of these black singers like Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin. And that was kind of the spark that ignited. Unfortunately, it took the death of America's greatest black leader of the time to kind of motivate these young white musicians to look inside their own hearts and souls and create their own music. And they did.
Okay. And that had to come out of the South.
And it had to come out of the South. It just had to.
We're talking about Southern rock with Mark Kemp. His new book is Dixie Lullaby, A Story of Music, Race, and New Beginnings in a New South. If you have a question or a particular memory of Southern rock yourself, you can give us a call here. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. We have more ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're talking this hour with Mark Kemp. His new book is Dixie Lullaby, A Story of Music, Race, and New Beginnings in a New South. Mark Kemp grew up in Ashboro, and then he went on to do a little bit of reporting in Burlington. Is that right?
Yes, and I would come to Chapel Hill often to cover shows.
Right, but you were a police beat reporter by day, and then you're writing about music at night. Is that right?
Exactly. I was moonlighting as a rock crit.
And that led you then. You left the state for 15 years, went to New York City.
Yes.
And did more writing, and had a magazine, and worked at MTV and Rolling Stone magazine. And yet you found that when you were writing this book a couple of years ago, you had to come back to North Carolina to write it. Why is that?
You know, I started writing it in New York. I had left MTV, and I had written the proposal, and I was really committed to kind of seeing this thing through. And I got through the preface, which you can read the preface and tell that it wasn't written down south. It's kind of romanticized a little bit. And then I wrote the introduction, which is pretty much all history. It's the background. It's Elvis. It's Otis Redding. It's, you know, all that, you know, pre-70s stuff. And then I started writing the first chapter, which was still kind of, it was moving into the 70s, but it was still like right around 68. And when I got to the 70s, I said, you know what? I've got to go back home. I can't do this justice without going back home, because I've only, you know, in the last 15 years, I'd only been to North Carolina a few times just to see the folks. And, you know, you don't get enough. And so I felt like I needed to live here again and really kind of experience it again.
Yeah, we should explain that part of this, during your time in New York, you were writing about other styles of music. And you, even when you went to college at ECU, you write that you just started to distance yourself from that Southern rock that had been so important to you when you were a teenager. And you just kind of abandoned it and just took on other.
Yeah.
Now, why was that? Was it because some of those things we were talking about, like Lynyrd Skynyrd just becoming more associated, whether rightfully or not, you know, with racism? Was it that, or is there a stereotype about Southern rock that you were getting away from?
It wasn't so much. I never thought of Lynyrd Skynyrd as a racist band. I, you know, that in retrospect, a lot of, you know, that's projection of some other sort that I don't really understand, because there's nothing really, particularly those earlier records, I don't really know so much about their later stuff, except I, you know, I've heard a little bit, but I never really understood the quote racism in Lynyrd Skynyrd. I just understood a band that was angry and singing about what they wanted. But no, it wasn't that so much as punk rock hit, you know, and punk rock was brand new and it spoke to me in a new way. And I was in college and Carter was in office and hostages were being taken and atrocious things were happening all over the world. And we had, you know, bands like The Clash and The Sex Pistols and The Ramones, not so much The Ramones being political, but, you know, The Clash singing about really political topics of the times, and that just swept me away. And to me, Lynyrd Skynyrd and to a lesser extent, the Allman Brothers just seemed quaint and old-fashioned.
Let's go to Thomas in Durham. Hi there, Thomas. Did you have a question for Mark Kemp?
Well, yeah, I sort of have a bit of a story to tell about myself. I was born in 1960, grew up in West Virginia, and you know, I was steeped in the whole Southern rock, Skynyrd and 38 Special and Charlie Daniels. And then I came to college at Davidson College down in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Near Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not really into it. I don't know, I was sort of in this musical netherworld. And then one of my friends had a friend at University of Georgia who sent him that single by R.E.M., Radio Free Europe and Sitting Still. And I remember sitting on his dorm floor listening to that for a couple of hours, just over and over, just sort of taking this in and just being pretty amazed that this, you know, this just sounded like something new. And of course, as you know, that just sort of spawned this whole new wave of, I mean, not new wave bands, but just a whole new thing of Southern bands. And
so that, now the question, I guess, for you, Mark Kemp, would be, R.E.M., would you label that as Southern rock as you would the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd?
It's Southern music, yeah. I mean, you know, it's Southern, it's rock made in the South, so yeah, it's Southern rock, you know. And in that case, I guess Elvis would be Southern rock. I'm not so hung up on the term Southern rock, and that's why it's not in the title of the book. I talk about it a lot in the book, but I'm not so hung up on the label. What these bands did, what these bands that I write about, and at the same time kind of mingle my own story and the story of other things like the culture of the South in between, is music from the South made by white people that expressed the evolution of thought that was going on at the time and continues to the present. And so, you know, I was talking about The Clash and The Sex Pistols and all that British punk rock that was coming over. And I had a similar reaction to R.E.M. My first reaction to R.E.M. actually was that I saw them at a club in Greenville, North Carolina, which is where I went to school at East Carolina University. And they were very new and very amateurish, and I thought they were awful. But then, as the listener said, I heard Radio Free Europe for the first time, and it absolutely blew me away, because what it did was it combined the attitude and the sensibility of punk rock with a very Southern sensibility. It still sounded very Southern, and indeed, two members of R.E.M. had played in Southern rock bands, so it had to be there.
You know what? Mark Kemp, we have a little bit of, I think this is from their first LP, or maybe even an EP, first LP. This is a track. Let's hear just a little bit of it from Murmur. This is called Pilgrimage.
Rest assured this will not last. Take a turn for the worst. Your hate clipped and distant. Your luck to never count.
R.E.M. from their first LP, Murmur, Pilgrimage there. And Mark Kemp, that was recorded where you are, in Charlotte. Well,
yes,
in the city of Charlotte, we should say.
Yes, Reflection Studio.
Yeah.
1983.
Yeah. And of course, REM is not the small band that you saw when you were at ECU at probably a small club in Greenville. Yeah.
No, they're one of the biggest rock bands of our period.
Now, is that good for them or bad for them, do you think? Because we talked a bit about how bands get so big and then they sometimes get away from that original intent.
REM is one of those rare bands, I think, that have somehow managed to maintain a sense of creative adventure. Not always. I think they've done some pretty crappy albums, but for the most part, they've grown and developed into quite a respectable veteran band.
Right. Joe in Greensboro is with us now. Greetings, Joe.
Hi. Hey, Mark. This is Joe Edmonds. You remember me?
Hey, Joe. How's it going?
Well, pretty good. I kept in touch with it, but tracks, I'm talking to Bob Burkhead and Richard Johnson through the years, so just keeping track of you that way.
But, oh, great. Wonderful.
Yeah. I'm glad you're doing well. I'm going to get your book, although you might remember that's not something I would have, listened to, other than the Allman Brothers Band, who I thought were a great group. I always thought.
So you were not a big fan of Southern rock in general?
No, not really. I was more into the British stuff, and then when the new wave stuff came along, or punk, whatever, it seemed like it kind of swept that away, and that's the point of it, Mark, to me. It seemed like it had a short shelf life, a short lifespan. The creativity they were drawing on just didn't carry through for a long time. I don't know if that was because of the commercial constraints that radio just puts on things, or the fact that it ran its course so quickly. What do you think about that?
It's interesting. Joe, you're the friend I met through Richard, right?
Joe?
Mm-hmm.
I met you through Richard Johnson, right?
That's right, yeah. We used to listen to records together up at his place.
Right. Joe, you're in the book. I don't know if you know that yet.
Oh, really?
You will find out when you read the book. Yeah, you're very instrumental in my evolution musically. So I am so grateful for you for that. You changed my my views and my listening habits in ways that have changed my life. So hey, Joe, you're pretty cool.
Well, I can remember us. I would take you to like the first Television album. We would like debate how much Tom Verlaine's style was impressed and maybe influenced by
Jerry Garcia
or whatever. Yeah.
Uh huh.
So now, but your point was that you felt that it had a short shelf life, and I'm curious, Mark, what you thought of that.
You're talking about Southern rock having a short shelf life.
Right, yeah, the lifespan. I mean, the Allmans were obviously a great group, and Leonard Skinner I have some grudge and respect for, but somebody get degraded quickly into the Molly Hatchets and whatever like that. With me, it was a sort of a metal offshoot with a little Southern fried metal in it. Somebody just lost its way pretty quickly.
Well, Joe, doesn't all music happen that way? I mean, pretty much all popular music happened that way. I mean, The Jam were so exciting when they first came out. The Jam was a punk rock, kind of a new wave punk rock band from England. And then but by the time that Green Day kind of were copying The Jam, it kind of became this kind of copy, that was a little less inspired than Setting Sun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think popular music's problem in a lot of ways is that it has a short shelf life. That's one of its problems, and that's also one of its assets. We can move on and on and on and on. But I see what you mean. The one thing that I kind of disagree with, having gone back and written this book and listened to this music again, is I'm amazed at how well a lot of the Allman Brothers music has held up because of its improvisational aspect, which,
They're a great group.
Mm-hmm. Right. A great group in the sense that maybe Ornette Coleman's original quartet was or Kind of Blue was, with Miles Davis.
Right.
Or the Yardbirds.
Or the Yardbirds.
Yeah.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you for your call, and I've just looked through the book, and I think that you're on page 145.
Well,
You went to a Devo show, right? We went to a Devo show,
and you... Remember, you got the pant leg of the yellow nuclear fallout shelter thing?
I think Richard grabbed one of those, yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, I attribute it to you.
That's what the band was throwing out from the stage as they ripped off parts of their clothes. Is that right?
Yes. We didn't go see the Dictator show, did we?
No, not you and I, huh?
Okay.
Well, Joey, page 145 in Mark Kemp's book, you'll find yourself there. Thanks for your call. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. We're talking with Mark Kemp. You know, Joey was talking about a short shelf life, and that may be for the bands putting out things that you may appreciate, you know, from how they sounded when they started. But it seems to me that, I mean, that music was around for years afterward. It was such a staple of rock radio when I was coming up through high school in the 70s. And, you know, even when I worked in radio in the early 80s, you could not, it was hard to get away from that.
Yeah.
That influence. And I this is not even in the South. I'm talking about in the southern part of Connecticut, too, elsewhere
right,
in the country.
Right, all over. Mm-hmm. I kind of disagree with Joe on that. I think, actually, if anything, a lot of the new wave and punk that we were listening to had a short shelf life, very important shelf life. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult for me to listen to some of the punk rock we were listening to because it just doesn't resonate now with me. A lot of it does. There are like great groups like Wire and I think The Clash to a certain extent, although their politics, you know, is a little dated. But Devo certainly, I don't think that they resonated at all at this point. You know, they sound so old and so, you know, short shelf life.
We have the luxury of a few years to look back at it right now. But, you know, you in your book, you write about how when you got to ECU in the, I guess it would be the late 70s, early 80s, you had a garage band and that you dreaded having people request Freebird.
Oh, God, yes.
Which I think a lot of DJs dreaded getting requests for, but certainly they came in. But you were able to act on this in a way because your band changed the words to Freebird, that
yeah,
Lynyrd Skynyrd classic that so many people ask for. How did you change them?
It wasn't very long after the plane crash. I guess we had our band in 79, 80. They crashed in 77, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And we changed I'm as free as bird now to I'm as dead as a bird now. And, you know, it was very punk rock at the time to be that kind of in your face. And we were a punk rock band. And a lot of the guys who kind of didn't catch on to the punk rock thing and wanted to hear Lynyrd Skynyrd didn't really appreciate our reverence too much. We also amped it up. We played it like kind of like the Sex Pistols were playing Freebird or something, you know, and we made it very short.
Right.
No guitar solos.
Right. And let's go now to, we have with us Tony, finally, in Southern Shores. Hi, Tony.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll be brief. It's funny, we're talking about shelf life. I'm 48 years old. I was fortunate enough to see the Seated Band before Dwayne passed away a year prior to that. And what's interesting about shelf life, I'm finding myself these days probably listening to, especially the Allman Brothers more than anything else, and the influence it's having upon my children. At first, it drove them crazy. They just couldn't. They didn't know what I was listening to. And now, my daughter, she's borrowing my CDs, my Allman Brothers CDs. And so it's kind of funny to see how things evolve or re-evolve. And that's why I wanted to bring it up about the shelf life aspect.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Tony. We really appreciate it. Mark Kemp, any final thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I totally agree. I think it's absolutely amazing when I go to an Allman Brothers show now with their brand new guitarist who's fantastic, Warren Haynes, and see so many kids who are so much younger than me. They could be my children, and they're just digging this music like crazy. So if anything, it's had quite a life.
Okay.
And but, you know, punk rock comes around, too. All music comes back around. New soul. There's this neo-soul movement with guys sounding like Otis Redding.
Right.
So it all comes back around.
Well, thanks for coming around to talk with us today, Mark Kemp.
No problem. I'd love I enjoyed it.
Mark Kemp is the entertainment editor at the Charlotte Observer and author of the new book, Dixie Lullaby, A Story of Music, Race, and New Beginnings in a New South. He'll be making appearances at bookstores throughout the state starting on Saturday. You can check all that information out at the SOT page on WUNC.org for more info. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show, you can drop us an email at SOT@WUNC.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Penkava.